It's time for Bigler's World. Bigler's World. For the next hour. That'll make me Jim Bigler for at least most of that hour. I got all kinds of magazines, kids' magazines all over the place here. Maybe some National Geographic Kids magazine. Sports Illustrated Kids. I'm not sure I have any of that. Let's start with Ranger Rick.
Shall we?
No, let's not. Let's start with Dogo News. I'll read that later. Dogo News for Kids. This article entitled, Northern Sea Robins Use Their Legs to Walk and Taste the Ocean Floor for Buried Prey. I've never heard of a sea robin. The robin is spelled R-O-B-I-N-S. Who wrote this? John Woo. Goes like this. The sea robin is a bottom-dwelling fish uniquely adapted to life on the ocean floor. These fascinating creatures have frog-like eyes, wing-like fins, and six crab-like legs. Scientists have now discovered that at least one species, the northern sea robin, uses these legs both for walking and for tasting the sea floor for buried prey, for buried treasure. Northern sea robins are native to the western Atlantic Ocean. They can be found from Nova Scotia to the Florida Keys and into the Gulf of Mexico. David Kingsley, a biologist at Stanford University, first caught sight of the unique fish at a small public aquarium in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. And this is him talking. The sea robins on display completely spun my head around because they had the body of a fish, the wings of a bird, and multiple legs like a crab. That's Kingsley talking to CNN in an email. I'd never seen a fish that looked like it was made of body parts from many different types of animals. Eager to learn more about this unusual fish, Kingsley teamed up with scientists at Harvard University. He brought some sea robin specimens from the aquarium to Harvard professor Nicholas Bellono's laboratory for a closer look. The team discovered that the fish's legs are actually extensions of its pectoral fins. However, unlike other fish with similar fin extensions, sea robins can move each leg independently. This makes these fish more adept at walking and digging across the ocean floor. In previous studies, researchers noticed that other fish tend to follow sea robins due to their ability to find buried prey. The researchers tested this by putting shellfish under the sand in a laboratory aquarium. Sure enough, the sea robins found the food using only their legs. Further investigation revealed that these legs contain sensory organs similar to those found on the human tongue. Yikes. They allow sea robins to taste the ocean floor as they walk around and find prey hidden below. However, not all sea robins share this unique ability. During their experiments, the researchers accidentally received a shipment of striped sea robins, another species found in the western Atlantic Ocean. Although the two species look similar, the striped sea robins did not dig or find buried prey. A closer look revealed that these fish did not have taste organs on their legs, says Kingsley. We were originally struck by the legs that were shared by all sea robins and make them different from most other fish. That's Kingsley. We were surprised to see how much sea robins differ from each other in sensory structures found on the legs. The scientists shared their findings in two, count them, two studies published in Current Biology. That was back October 7th. Of 2024. They suggest that since only a few sea robin species have taste organs, the fish's legs initially evolved for movement. Later, certain species developed the additional ability to use these limbs to find food. Deadly freaky. Let's do one more article in Dogo News right here on Bigler's World. Remote Alaskan town will see its final sunset of 2024 on November 19th. Is that today? Daksha Morjaria wrote this particular article. The next time you are upset about short winter days, think about, see if I can pronounce this, Utqokwakavik formerly Barrow, Alaska, the residents of America's northernmost town will experience their final sunset this year on November 19th, 2024. They will not see the sun again until January 23rd of 2025. For those wondering, that is 65 straight days or 1,560 hours of darkness. Who is the CNN meteorologist Judson Jones, says, "This happens every year. If you live above the Arctic Circle, there will be a day when the sun sets for the rest of the winter. The good news, it will return. And then during the summer, it won't set for days," which has to be annoying. Barrow, or Yutaquikvik, its long polar night is due to its location just 1,300 miles south of the North Pole. Our planet orbits the sun at a 23.5 degree tilt. During winter, areas near the poles tilt away from the sun, leaving them with little or no sunlight. For the North Pole, this period lasts from September to March. While Yutaquikvik residents will not see the sun, they will still have some light during the day. The sun's rays bend around the Earth and appear just above the horizon. This phenomenon, known as civil twilight, is similar to the light we see at sunrise before the sun fully emerges. It creates beautiful blue, orange, and pink hues as the sun's rays scatter through the Earth's atmosphere. Initially, this twilight will last for about 6 hours each day, but by mid-December, it will shorten to just 3 hours as the North Pole tilts further away from the sun. Yutaquikvik is the first Alaskan town to experience a polar night each year, but it is not the only one. No, no, no. In coming weeks, the residents of Kaktovik, Point Hope, and Anaktuktovuk Pass will also say goodbye to the sun for a few months. Northern regions of Finland, Norway, Sweden, and parts of Scotland also experience this phenomenon, though for shorter periods. Residents in these areas are well rewarded for enduring the dark and cold winters. During the summer, they enjoy the midnight sun, when the sun remains visible both day and night. For Yutaquikvik, this will mean no sunset for 82 consecutive days from May 12th of 2025 to July 31st of 2025. Okay, enough with Dogo news for the time being. Let's read an article from Ranger Rick. This is the Ask Scarlet section here, written by Kathy Cranking. These kids write in. Adam from New York says, "What's the difference between a centipede and a millipede?" And Scarlet says, "Well, both are long, creepy crawlies with segmented bodies and lots of legs. But if you look at the pictures below, right here, down here, see those pictures? You'll see that there are several ways to tell them apart. Centipedes have flat bodies and one pair of legs per body segment. Their name means hundred-footed, but most kinds have around 30 legs. Some have more than 300, though. Centipedes eat spiders, moths, and other small prey. Millipedes have round bodies and two pairs of legs per segment. Their name means thousand-footed. No millipede has 1,000 legs, but at least one kind has as many as 750. Mm-hmm. Millipedes eat plants." And Gavin from Texas writes, "Why do flies land on me?" I got an idea about that, but she's going to answer this. "Because you're good enough to eat. Next time a fly lands on you, watch it closely for a while instead of shooing it away. You'll notice his mouth parts dabbing at your skin." That's creepy. What's going on? Well, they're soaking up the oils or sweat that may be there. And for a fly, that makes a good meal. After the fly leaves, be sure to wash the area it landed on. Flies carry lots of germs. Okay, Paul from Delaware, he wants to know, "How do lost cats and dogs find their way home from many miles away?" Well, the stories you hear about such long-distance travelers may be hard to believe, but some of them are true. How do cats and dogs get home from far away? Well, maybe they use their keen sense of smell. Maybe they can tell direction by the position of the sun and the stars. And some wild animals can when migrating. Or maybe they use a sense of direction that we just don't know about yet. No one, including scientists, knows for sure. Except your hairdresser. I think your hairdresser knows for sure. Okay, let's go to another magazine here for kids. Sports Illustrated for kids. Following Other Footsteps is the name of this article. Many children have gone down the same path as their athlete parents. Most memorably, Ken Griffey and his son Ken Jr. played alongside each other in the outfield for the Seattle Mariners back in 1990, and something similar could happen in the NBA this season now that Bronny James and his dad LeBron could share the court. But not all offspring stick to the sport they grew up watching their parents play. No, no, no. Okay, they got Pat Mahomes and Patrick Mahomes. You make the call. Okay, what do they got here? Pat enjoyed an 11-year major league career as a pitcher, so his son grew up in the clubhouse, as the elder Mahomes put it. Patrick was good enough to be picked by the Detroit Tigers in the 2014 draft and spent a season on the Texas Tech baseball team. But eventually, he decided his future lay on a different field, much to the delight of the Chief fans. And then there's Peter Korda and Nelly Korda. Both Peter Korda and his wife, Regina Rajachotova, were professional tennis players. Peter was ranked high as number 2 in the world, almost as high as the ranking as his youngest daughter has on the golf course. Earlier this year, Nelly won 5, count them, 5 LPGA tournaments in a row. Her older sister, Jessica, is also a golf pro, but the kids didn't totally neglect mom and dad's sport. Brother Sebastian is a tennis pro. Then you got Mike Connolly Sr. and Mike Connolly Jr. The elder Connolly was the best in the world at the triple jump for years, winning Olympic gold back in 1992, but it was always apparent that his son would go in a different direction, said Mike Jr. Even as a one-year-old, I was obsessed with bouncy balls, so it was clear basketball was my future. Mike Jr., who is in his 18th year in the NBA, in his NBA season. I don't know what the difference is. How about Popeye Jones and Seth Jones? Popeye's 11-year NBA career included many stops, including hockey mad Denver. That's where his son Seth picked up the game as a 5-year-old, with tips from Hall of Famer Joe Sakic, who played in the same building as Popeye for the Avalanche. Now with the Blackhawks, Seth is a 4-time All-Star. Dennis Rodman and Trinity Rodman, one of the greatest ever at grabbing rebounds. Hall of Famer Dennis Rodman and his daughter, who prefers to use her feet, Trinity, tried basketball as a kid but fell in love with soccer. This is her talking here. She said back in 2021, Dennis was an amazing athlete, and I got those genes from him. She used them well, playing in the World Cup and striking Olympic gold. Next article here, entitled Return to Center in Sports Illustrated, sticking with Sports Illustrated for kids. At the U.S. Boomerang Nationals in September, Cam Brosnan finished an impressive 19th. Even more impressive, he's only 10 and was competing against athletes of all ages. Cam stumbled onto the sport after watching Logan Broadbent's trick shot videos with Dude Perfection on the internet back when he was 4. Cam's dad bought him a boomerang when they reached out to Broadbent, who became something of a mentor. Broadbent won the Nationals, by the way. Boomerangs are a fun hobby, but not many people know that competitions exist. Athletes get points in a variety of disciplines. Some reward accuracy, some reward a competitor's ability to catch the returning boomerang, and others reward style. While Cam enjoys competing against grown-ups and is very good at it, he also encourages kids to get out and try the sport. Says Cam, I think it's cool. Sports Illustrated for Kids wants you, it says here at the bottom of the article. It's that time of the year. If you think you have what it takes to be our Sports Kid of the Year, have an adult submit your nomination to SportsKid, that's all one word, sportskid@si.com. We're looking to honor kids who excel in sports, the classroom, and the community. Next article here, sticking with Sports Illustrated Kids. 4 score and 7 shanks ago, And the four is spelled F-O-R-E. Holding the highest office in the land doesn't mean a person can't have time for sports. No, no. Presidents, even former ones, are protected by the Secret Service. But who protects the public, specifically golf fans, from presidents? Consider the round that Gerald Ford, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton played together with some pros in front of a large gallery at a 1995 tournament. Clinton put his first drive into a sand trap. A later shot landed in someone's yard. Ford then yanked his ball into the crowd. A later shot hit a woman's finger. Bush's second shot on the first hole also struck a woman. A few holes later, he doinked a man with a ball, explained Clinton, "We were nervous as cats." Running mates. Mascot races are the staple of baseball games, especially national games, where oversized presidents have been taking a lap in the middle of the fourth inning since 2006. Says, can you ID the six competitors from the 2015 race? You got Calvin Coolidge, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, William Taft, George Washington. First fans. William H. Taft became the first president to throw out the first pitch at a baseball game at the Washington Senators' 1910 opener. He stayed all nine innings and reportedly enjoyed himself, probably more than Secretary of State Charles G. Bennett, who took a foul ball to the head. He was fine, it says here. On a roll, for his birthday in 1947, Harry Truman received a bowling alley, which was installed in the White House basement. 8 years later, it was removed from the residence so more people could use it. Oh, from the residence. But Richard Nixon bowled on it so often that he had a new alley installed in the White House back in 1973. Ford on the field. So who has been the best presidential athlete? George H.W. Bush played baseball at Yale. Abe Lincoln was a wrestler. Teddy Roosevelt was a boxer. But they can't top Gerald Ford, who won two national titles as a football player at Michigan, garnering interest from the Packers and the Lions. And they got one more section here. Bracketology? What is this? One thing Americans of all political ideologies can agree upon is that when March rolls around, you'll find out an NCAA tournament bracket. You'll fill out. Sorry, not find out. It is unlikely any president has been a more avid hoopster than Barack Obama, who made a tradition of making his men and women's picks on national television. Okay, then there was, what is this here? This article entitled Storm Warning. Bum, 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 bum. There was a moment in June, shortly after the draft, when Thunder general manager Sam Presti, I think that's how it's pronounced, Presti, he sat down to address the media. Before he discussed his team's picks, he thanked his scouts, the people whose legwork and time spent traveling helped Presti decide who to select. The evaluators and the scouts spend so much time away. They travel all over the world. There's a lot of rental car returns at 5 in the morning, connecting flights to far-off lands. There's a million stories like that. Well, they had better get used to it because they're going to be remarkably busy for the next several years. Oklahoma City has amassed a staggering bounty of draft picks, as many as 25, including 12 first-rounders, in the next 5 years. Okay, let's go to another publication altogether. Frontiers for Young Minds is this particular one. This, the article is entitled, Robots That Can Survive the Egg Drop. William R. Johnson III wrote this, along with Rebecca Kramer, Batoglio. And it goes like this here. Tense, gritty robots are inspired by art. Tense, gritty? I've never heard of that. That's all one word. 70 years ago, an artist named Kenneth Snelson started to build the interesting sculptures you see in this figure here. What are they? They're just like big X's, big metal X's. They look like antennas. They have stiff bars tied together by tight cables. The cables make it look like the bars are floating. Snelson's teacher was an architect named Buckminster Fuller. Fuller called these floating sculptures, tense gritty. The word comes from tension and integrity. Tension means the cables are tight Integrity means the sculptures stay together. Fuller and other architects noticed that tensegrity sculptures are useful. They can be used to build structures like a roof or a bridge. Tensegrity is mostly empty space. Structures built with a tensegrity can be lightweight and even cost less money. Many years later, engineers started to build tensegrity robots. Tensegrity robots do not look like normal robots. Instead, they are made of stiff bars and tight cables, just like tensegritties. Alrighty. These robots have the same advantages as tensegritties, that they are lightweight, flexible, and mostly empty space. You can even fold up tensegritty robots so that they are easy to send to faraway places, like other planets.
I'm getting it now.
There is one more big advantage to tensegritty robots. They can survive falling off a cliff. When a tensegritty robot crashes into the ground, its shape will deform to absorb the impact. You can understand how this happens if you've ever jumped on a trampoline. It does not hurt to fall on a trampoline because the trampoline is flexible and deforms when you land on it, unlike falling on cement. Tensegritty robots are also flexible like trampolines, so they absorb the energy from impacts. Engineers at NASA are excited to build tensegritty robots for this reason. They want to make tensegritty robots that can crash land on other planets or that can roll into craters and explore the bottom. See, it commands me to watch a NASA tensegritty robot here. I'm just not going to do that right now. Sorry, I'm going to read this. Future tensegritty robots will have to protect the scientific instruments they carry. That is even harder than the egg drop challenge from school. After it survives the drop, the tensegritty robot must explore its surroundings. But how can we build a tensegritty robot that will get them to move? How can we make tensegritty robots move? Is the next section here. If you stand on your tiptoes and lean forward, you will fall over. You might be surprised to learn that this is how tensegritty robots move around. When you're standing up normally, your center of gravity is directly above your feet. Even if you lean forward a little bit, your center of gravity will still be above your feet, so you will not fall. When you stand on your tiptoes, the area your feet support is smaller, so now leaning forward even just a little can make you fall. Instead of feet, tensegritty robots have a structure called a polygon of stability as their bottom face. When a tensegritty robot shrinks its polygon of stability, it is like standing on tiptoes. Then the robot can deform its shape and fall over or roll over by pushing its center of gravity outside of its polygon stability. The tensegritty robot can keep rolling and falling over again onto the next face. Other tensegritty robots use different strategies for locomotion. In addition to rolling, some of these robots crawl, jump, vibrate, and even swim. Most of these robots move by using electric motors to make their cables longer or shorter. Other tensegritty robots use inflatable actuators to get their bodies to deform. There's a lot of variety when it comes to tensegritty robots, which makes them cool and exciting to study. But it can be difficult to design a new tensegritty robot because there are so many choices to make. Simulations help us design and control tensegritty robots, is the next section here. Building robots can cost lots of money. Sometimes we do not know what type of robot to build for a task. Even when we do, we might not know how to get it to move. It's easy to understand the locomotion of a car, spin the wheels to move forward, and turn the front wheels to turn. Unlike a car, tensegritty locomotion is not obvious. Which cables should the robot pull to move forward or turn? Engineers solve these problems by making simulations on a computer. The simulation is like a video game. In a video game, you can control a character, making it run and jump. The game calculates where you land using physics and math. Simulations do the same thing, but for robots. Simulations predict what a robot will do when we give it the same controls, or some controls, which help us figure out the best controls. The simulation can also tell us how good a robot will be before we build it. We can make simulations with lots of different tense, gritty robots. These robots can have a different number of bars, different shapes, and different sizes. Then we can compare their speeds or another property to choose which robot is the best one. We can even use the simulation to find out the best strategy for locomotion. Just like you can run, walk, crawl, and swim, tense, gritty robots have different ways that they can move around. The best way to move depends on the surroundings. Simulations tell us if certain tense, gritty robots can roll or crawl. They can also tell us which cables it needs to pull on to move a certain way. It's hard to make simulations of tense, gritty robots because these robots are flexible, which makes it more complicated to predict what they will do. Also, when a tense, gritty robot pulls on one cable to make it shorter, that will affect all the other cables in the tense, gritty. With these challenges, researchers keep making better simulations for these robots. No matter how hard we try, we will never simulate a robot perfectly. The problem is called the sim-to-real gap. There are lots of things in the real world that are hard to measure precisely. Even if we could, the real world has some randomness that is impossible to predict. Simulations are useful for figuring out how to design and control tense, gritty robots. Still, we must build the real robot and test it to check the simulation. Then we can be happy if our simulation is accurate. Tense, gritty robots in the future. When Kenneth Nelson was making art sculptures 70 years ago, he did not know that his work might lead to robots that explore other planets. Today, engineers keep designing new and better tense, gritty robots. One day, these robots might search underground caves or the bottoms of craters. They might do other things that we have not even imagined. No one thought art would become a robot one day. There are still problems to solve, though. Tense, gritty robots can be difficult to design, simulate, and control. And these robots are also not as reliable as robots with wheels or even legs. More research is needed for tense, gritty robots to reach their full potential. Maybe you will be the one to solve these problems. Okay, let's go to another publication here on Bigler's World. Bop-a-doop-a-doo on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Let's go north of the border here with CBC Kids News. Kids News, Kids News. They got a Q&A from climate lawsuits to COP29. Activist Sophia Mathur shares her story. I think Angelica Cooper wrote this. Let's see, what do we got here? Sophia Mathur may just be 17, but she spent more than half of her life as a climate activist. At age 7, she was writing to politicians, using art as a way to draw attention to climate change. At 11, she was among the first students in Canada to join the Fridays for Future Climate Strike movement. She took part from her hometown in Sudbury, Ontario. At 12, she joined a lawsuit with other young activists against the Ontario government. From striking with Greta Thunberg in New York to fighting for climate initiatives in Egypt, Sophia has dedicated her life to amplifying youth voices and pushing for change. Most recently, on October 17th, she and a group of other youth had a major climate win in the Ontario courts. Sophia is part of a group that is suing Premier Doug Ford's government, that is, for not going far enough to fight climate change. Originally, the case was dismissed, but now they've learned that through an appeal, there will be a new hearing. The next step is more court proceedings, and Sophia is hopeful. As we head into the next UN Climate Change Conference in Azerbaijan on November 11th, wait a minute, we're already there, CBC Kids News spoke to Sophia to find out what her hopes are for the next era of climate activism. This conversation has been edited for length and clarity. Okay, so the question is, your appeal was successful. Your lawsuit centered around climate change and the Ontario government is going ahead. Can you take me through when you found out? And she says, well, I was at school when the announcement was made, and I had expected it to come at a certain time, but it was about 15 minutes later. So there was a lot of anticipation for it, and I was initially very confused about the decision. But now I'm looking at it, I'm really, really happy. Obviously, it means that we're going to have more court dates and more to go to, but it's not like that wasn't expected. So it's given me a lot of faith in this case, and I'm glad that this decision is getting the attention that it deserves. This could really define the rest of my year and like the rest of my activism career. So there was a lot of anxiety and a lot of anticipation. So wait, how did you find out in class? Tell me about that. Well, I was in art class, and we were learning about art history, but I was on my laptop with WhatsApp open, making sure I didn't miss the message from the group chat of the other kids on the lawsuit. Since it's a WhatsApp group chat, some people were sending GIFs, like little Snoopy dances and things like that. Because at the end of the day, like, obviously, it's serious. It's a serious case, and it's a lot of work, but we spent so much time together. It's almost like we're friends, and we had that special connection. So there's a lot of vulnerability of people, like just being really excited and really happy that we get to continue on. So there's definitely some happy reactions, eh? So COP29, a yearly climate conference is coming up. You're not going this year, but you've been in the past. From your perspective, how useful are these big international conferences? Well, I think it's very useful if people pay attention to them. I think if governments go to these meetings and they're making promises and they're saying that they're going to do things, then it's the citizens' responsibility to hold them accountable. But if no one's paying attention, then no one's there to hold them accountable. So I do think that there's a big benefit to these meetings. The influence of youth at these meetings on the street, there's thousands of people protesting. There's almost a lot of pressure. There's almost a lot of pressure, especially since a lot of government representatives from countries around the world are there, eh? If world leaders were to accomplish one thing at COP29, what do you hope it would be and why? Well, I hope to see more follow-up with the promises and the policies that they commit to. So I really, really want to see that commitment to climate, not just around this time every year. I want to see it all year round and from every political party and every world leader in a sense of cooperation. And also listening to experts and taking away from really what these meetings mean and how many things that could get done if world leaders would see climate change as a nonpartisan issue. Any advice for the next generation of strikers or kids who want to make a difference? Well, your action is so important. I've always been a really artistic child. I used to draw cards for politicians when I went into their offices when I was 7. I recommend including those passions in their activism as a way to engage with specific communities and use what they're good at for those things. Literally, anybody can get engaged. You don't have to start a movement. You don't have to do things that are way too far out of your comfort zone. It all starts with a starting conversation with people, figuring out who to engage with, and learning locally what other people are doing. It's never too late to start, and it's never too early to start. Okay, let's go to a little science. Science News Explores. This article entitled, Science Works to Demystify Hair and Help It Behave. Growing data can help us control our hair, even extra curly, to keep it looking its best, says Kathy Ann Kowalski. Michelle Gaines' hair naturally curls into tight coils. Keeping it neat and healthy has proven a challenge for this busy polymer chemist. She's read all those product promises and watched online videos about how to tame it. Her friend's well-meaning advice didn't help much either. Let's see, who is this? Gaines works at Spelman College in Atlanta, Georgia, and she says, it's literally been trial and error. In frustration, she turned to her science. Human hair can vary in texture, shape, and curl patterns. These differences affect its strength and more. So, too, do our hair care practices and treatments. Gaines is among a growing number of scientists working to better understand these strands of fibrous protein that sprout from our heads. Some researchers are focusing on what the differences in curly hair mean for its strength and other traits. Others are probing how varying hair and scalp conditions affect our locks. Still others are studying hair care practices and hair care products, including shampoos and conditioners. Some of their findings could help you take better care of your hair or point to personal do's and don'ts. After all, no matter what type you're born with, you want it to be healthy, and we all want our hair to look awesome, totally awesome. Straight, curly, what type do you have? Everyone's hair has the same basic chemical composition, yet from one person to the next, these strands popping out of our scalps vary greatly. One of the most obvious ways is in their curliness, but they can also naturally differ in thickness, color, pigments, strength, texture, and more. Hair is mostly made up of proteins, such as keratin. It also has small amounts of lipids or fatty substances and sugars. Scientists have shown that the types of protein in straight hair can vary a bit from those in curly hair, but what we know about those differences doesn't yet provide a good way to classify hair, says Gabriella Daniels. She's part of a hair research team at the London College of Fashion in England. It's part of the University of the Arts of London, by the way. Some studies have tried to organize hair types based on broad racial groups, but people in any one group don't all have similar hair. For example, the hair of people whose ancestors came from Europe can range from very straight to wavy or tightly coiled. It can be thin or thick, oily or dry, brittle or bouncy, and it can naturally vary as much in color as it does in texture and strength. Plus, many people's ancestors come from multiple places, so the genes that tell our hair how to grow can differ a lot, even within a family. Some traits do show up more often in groups whose ancestors came from some particular part of the world. Still, even the hair of individuals whose ancestors came from the same place can differ broadly, and there's a lot of overlap among groups from different places on a range of traits. That includes how and how much the hair strands curl. Until recently, Sandra Koch worked at Pennsylvania State University in University Park. While there, she was part of a team that studies characteristics of human hair. In the American Journal of Biological Anthropology this past July, they showed how measurements of different traits vary across and within groups whose ancestors come from different parts of the world. Based on those data, they now argue for getting rid of the outdated racial categories for hair. Assigning generic ethnic labels can prove misleading, Koch says, because hair really is variable. Koch now works as a forensic scientist at the National Institute of Standards and Technology in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Ideally, she says, people from in forensics share as much information about trace evidence as possible. Features of hair samples, for instance, might be more common among groups whose ancestors come from some geographic region, but detectives also need to realize how widely any group's hair varies. Doing so may keep them from inappropriately eliminating suspects based on findings about hair at a crime scene, she says. It may also strengthen the value of this evidence if a case goes to trial. Under the microscope and in the stretchers. Okay. Teens aren't likely to go to trial over their hair, but various features matter when it comes to how they care for it. That's why the hair care industry has been working on other ways to classify hair. Back in 2007, scientists at L'Oréal in France divided hair into 8 groups based on its curliness. About a decade earlier, hairstylist Andre Walker defined hair groups based on curl, texture, and other traits. Most recently, Gaines and her team have turned to scanning electron microscopes and other tools to classify hair. Let's see, they got a picture of one here. Shows the cuticle, which isn't the very outside, but the second outside, then the medulla and the cortex. This shows the general structure of a cross-section of strand of hair. That cross-section in tightly coiled hair tends to be more elliptical than circular. A hair shaft grows from a structure in the skin called a hair follicle. The outer layer, called the cuticle, has overlapping bits known as shingles. I don't like the sound of that. On straight or wavy hair, these usually lay flat and smooth, Gaines says. The next layer, the cortex, makes up most of the hair's shaft volume. The thin innermost layer is the medulla. It is most notable in thick or coarse hair. Fine blonde hairs may have no medulla at all. It's sad. Gaines' group then went on to suggest using additional geometric measurements to classify very curly hair. Among other things, the team measured the length of the contour waves that make up each hair strand's curls. How far apart do the waves on them crest, and how many contour waves fit along each 3-centimeter or 1.2-inch span of hair? Previous work had generally relied on simply eyeballing categories to rate hair's curliness. The extremely fine details that Gaines' group has collected now establish very precisely how tightly someone's hair naturally curls. Such measurements might one day help companies develop hair care products that work better for specific hair types, Gaines says. Then, once you know which type is yours, you pick your shampoos and conditioners made to work best for your tresses. Her team shared its new approach to classifying curly hair last year in Accounts of Chemical Research at a meeting of the American Chemical Society. Fragile strands. Among other features, Gaines' group measured hair's tensile strength. That's how much load it can support before it breaks. Curlier hair will stretch out more as pulling straightens it, her team showed. Breakage can then swiftly follow. This confirmed what earlier studies had found. Bending hair also stresses it, notes Daniels, at the London College of Fashion. Twisting, what scientists call torsional force, also takes its toll. So, for the full length of curly hair, may not bear a load as well as some small segment of it. Strands of curly hair also tend to intertwine or tangle more easily than other types, and the more tangles, the greater the risk the hair will break. Friction, too, is hard on some types of hair, Daniels points out. Even a pillowcase can cause friction at night, she says. In hopes of reducing that, some people with tightly curled locks will sleep on silk or satin pillowcases, or they may don sleep bonnets before going to bed. Moisture is another issue. Everyone's scalp exudes a natural oil called sebum. Small amounts on the hair help it hold moisture, but this protective oil may not reach the ends of long or tightly coiled hair. Differences in thickness may also affect how fragile curly hair is, says Katerina Fernandez. She's a chemical engineer at the University of Coimbra in Portugal. Cross sections of curly hair are more likely to look like ovals than circles. People of African ancestry with very curly hair also tend to have more variation than other groups in the diameter of a hair's shaft along its length, she noted, so it may have more points of weakness. Hair is also more fragile when it is wet or exposed to excessive heat, such as curling irons or hair dryers. Researchers in South Africa showed this with samples from one curly-haired woman in her 30s. The data showed how changing conditions can affect someone's hair. At that same time, data from just one person meant that the team can't say its findings apply to all. Where are your hair cleansers doing? I'm sorry, what are they doing? Hair care products aren't yet tailored as finely as Gaines would like, but companies do offer products for general hair types, such as fine hair or coarse hair. Whatever traits your hair has, try to pick products designed for your tresses, Daniels suggests. Everyone wants their shampoo to remove dirt and sweat, but those products also take out naturally protective oils. So many products include moisturizers. Super curly hair tends to be especially prone to dryness and frizz, though. For people with very curly locks, Gaines' team saw their hair shaft shingles were packed so tightly together that they wouldn't lie flat. That lets moisture escape. Moisture leaves wind shingles on hair cuticles don't evenly overlap each other. Moisturizing products can help with that. Another thing everyone should consider is a shampoo's pH. A pH of 7 is neutral. Anything higher is alkaline. And a hair shaft with a pH of about 3.7 is fairly acidic. The scalp is less so, with a pH of around 5.5. So why would a shampoo's pH matter? Well, alkaline can increase negative electrical charges on the hair surface. That increases friction and static electricity, and it could lead to cuticle damage and breakage. Washing with hot water can also open the hair's cuticles. A slightly acidic pH allows cuticles to close up, notes Procter & Gamble, a maker of many hair care products. The issue is more pressing for curly hair, whose cuticle might be generally open, allowing more moisture to escape. These people, said the company, might require a slightly acidic product to close it up. So how might you identify an acidic shampoo? Well, short of doing a chemistry experiment, you won't. When the 2014 study was done, the team analyzed 123 international brands of shampoo. Fewer than 4 in 10 had a pH lower than 5.5. The study's authors called for more work to find out what pH level might be best for scalp and hair health. They also suggested listing the pH on product labels. Many companies still don't do this, but according to Shanaz Shirazi, editor of Salon Worthy Hair in London, England, there is a way to find out if a shampoo is low pH or not. Because that information is not on the label, you have to track down each product's MSDS, short for Material Safety Data Sheet. Let's see, who is this talking? Shirazi says, we've researched over 470 shampoos and hair products, gathered their MSDS, asked manufacturers for details directly, and tested some with an electronic pH meter. We found only 28 low pH shampoos. She filtered out those using the least chemicals and better reviews. And she posted them on her blog November 6th, 2023. That was a year ago. In the journal Polymers last year, pick yours up today, Fernandez's team at Coimbra reported data on three ways conditioners might help with pH issues. Some of them adjust hair's negative electric charge that can somewhat counter the effects of alkaline shampoos. Conditioners can coat hair strands with a film, which smooths the surface, and that can restore shine and make hair feel softer. Still other conditioners aim to strengthen hair with tiny bits of protein. Remember, Fernandez notes, hair is mainly made up of proteins, so if it gets highly porous due to damage, we can use small proteins to penetrate the hair fibers and get some of these lost proteins restored. Think of it as adding extra bits of blocks to a wobbly Jenga tower. Filling in some weak spots makes the hair stronger, but, she adds, this is just a physical interaction. The next time you wash your hair, shampoo will remove some or all of those bits of protein, so ongoing conditioning is needed, her team notes. Caring for your locks. Hair care research should factor in how people feel about their hair, as well as how they take care of it, says Daniels. She and Maxi Heitmeier, they recently shared ideas about this in International Journal of Cosmetic Science. Heitmeier, a social psychologist, also works at the University of the Arts in London. For one July 2024 paper, their team talked with 14 curly-haired people about their hair care routines. They also asked how these people wanted their hair to look and feel. The team used the answers to build a category system that focused on different goals for managing hair. The system worked especially well for people with curly hair. They reported this in October. The pair chose to focus on curly hair because that group has often been overlooked in other studies. Their new findings might help hair care product labs set up test conditions that better reflect how people take care of their hair. It can also help stylists better match products to their clients' needs. The findings might even help customers begin to focus better on specific goals for their hair and how they want to care for it. For instance, some people have to share bathrooms with lots of other people, getting little time there to themselves. For such people, the product that must be used on wet hair may prove a hassle. Super curly hair comes with challenges, but it can look great in a variety of styles. Choose look, products, and practical routine that will be good for your hair so it stays strong and healthy. And no matter what kind of tresses you have, says Daniels, how we feel about our hair makes a difference. You don't have to spend a whole lot of time or money, but learning the science of hair could pay off. And it's good to think about what you want to get out of hair care routine that's practical for you. Indeed, says Daniels, teens should be able to learn a bit more about their hair and look after it in a way that's easy and fun. When our hair looks good, we're more likely to feel good, too. Okay, next article here. We'll stick with science news. Explorers. Let's learn about ancient pyramids, is the name of this article. People around the world have built pyramids throughout history, says Maria Temming, who wrote this article. When you think of ancient pyramids, your mind probably goes to Egypt. Ancient Egyptians built these monuments as tombs for kings, starting at around 2700 BC. Perhaps the most famous of these are the three pyramids of Giza near Cairo. But people all over the globe have built pyramids throughout history, and some were just as magnificent as ancient Egypt's. The people in the kingdom of Kush, in what is now Sudan, built pyramids between around 700 BC and 300 BC. These Nubian pyramids were generally smaller and more pointier than those in Egypt, but like those in Egypt, these structures were used as royal tombs. The Great Pyramid of Cholula, meanwhile, dwarfs even the Great Pyramid of Giza, the largest of the Giza trio. In the modern Mexican state of Puebla, it stands some 450 meters, that's 1,500 feet wide. The Great Pyramid of Giza is about 230 meters or 750 feet wide. In fact, the Great Pyramid of Cholula is several mud pyramids stacked on top of each other. Little is known about its early history, but construction is thought to have started around 300 BC. By the time Spanish invaders arrived in the 1500s, the pyramid was overgrown by grass. Residents of the holy city of Teotihuacan, I can't pronounce these things, built their own impressive pyramids. The city is located in present-day Mexico. Structures there include the pyramids of the sun and the moon and the temple of Quetzalcoatl, that's the feathered serpent pyramid. All were built there within the first few hundred years A.D. Not much is known about the people who constructed them, but the pyramids appear to have been used for rituals and burials. People in multiple ancient Maya cities likewise built pyramids. Take the ancient city of Tikal in modern-day Guatemala. This was a thriving urban center until around 900 AD and is where several pyramid temples were built. Pyramids are also found at the ancient Maya city of Caracol in what is now Belize, and there are temple pyramids in Maya city only recently uncovered in southern Mexico named Valeriana. More ancient pyramids are found elsewhere in Africa, Europe, Asia, and South America. Okay, let's go over to news for kids right here on Bigler's World. Philippines hit by multiple typhoons. See if I can pronounce this. Camarines. I'm going to say that. Philippines. Over the last month, the Philippines have been hit by six, count them, six major storms, including five typhoons. The latest storm, Super Typhoon Manji, struck on Saturday night, forcing hundreds of thousands of people from their homes and causing serious damage. The Philippines is made up of around 7,500 islands in the Pacific Ocean. Every year, the country gets hit by about 20 storms or typhoons. Most people in the Philippines have learned to expect storms, but the last few weeks have been challenging, even for the best prepared people. In late October, the country was hit by Tropical Storm Trami and Typhoon Kong Rei. I like these names. Those storms affect millions of people, forced nearly 300,000 people from their homes, and left roughly 150 people dead. Following that, in the last 11 days alone, the country has been hit by four more typhoons. The first storm this month, Typhoon Yijing, I think that's how you pronounce it, made landfall November 7th. With speeds of up to 110 miles per hour. It dropped massive amounts of rain on areas of the Philippines, causing landslides. 4 days after that, the country was hit by Typhoon Toraji. On November 14th, the Philippines was hit by another powerful storm, Typhoon Usagi, which hit with 130 mile per hour winds. Without giving the islands a chance to recover, Super Typhoon Manji showed up just 2 days later. Manji first hit the Philippines in Catanduans, I don't know if that is right, on Saturday night. It brought winds of up to 150 miles per hour. As the storm moved on, it crossed open water and hit land again on the main island of Luzon. Manji brought strong winds, heavy rain, and flooding. The storm knocked down houses and the rain triggered landslides, which have killed at least eight people. In the northern Philippines, hundreds of homes were flooded after a river overflowed. The province of Camarines is one of the places that was hit the hardest. All through the area, houses are damaged, the electricity is out, and there is no running water. A government worker in Camarines said that the people had not recovered from the previous storms when the super typhoon hit. The steady stream of storms has left the country in shock. In all, the storms have affected about 9 million people, causing damage to roads, farms, and buildings. Close to 8,000 homes have been damaged or destroyed. Currently, around 700,000 people have been forced to leave their homes and are staying in emergency shelters or with relatives. The storm knocked out power in over 100 areas and left many people without enough food or drinking water. Many areas are also in need of building supplies to fix their homes. The damage in the Philippines is so serious and so widespread that it will take time to recover. Several countries have offered to help, including the U.S., Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Brunei. The U.S. has offered $1 million and says that U.S. soldiers in the country will also help out. For now, at least, the country will have little time to recover. Currently, no major storms appear to be headed toward the Philippines. And with that, I am out of time. This is Bigler for Bigler's World. I'll read with you next week. Until then, bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.